So every retreat in the last few years at this time, just keeping tradition, and this is the time when the book of Yonah is read in the Beit Knesset, and exactly this time, and it's become for me a personal ritual, and partly because my Jewish name is Yonah, and partly because my father used to read this every year for 20 years in the Beit Knesset. He used to read Yonah. So I'm sort of following a little bit the chain of that. And I think it's a very relevant time for this story, because we're in the journey of Yom Kippur, or the journey of any retreat or any inner spiritual work, as we come through the passageway of our practice and we meet the places in us which are underneath the usual mind, then up comes the question, so now what? What next? It's like the shortest Dharma story ever, I think, is about this guy that goes to the searching in the Himalayas for the great teacher, and he goes for a whole year looking for the great teacher, and they eventually finds him. He's an old man with a great bundle of sticks on his shoulder that he's carrying for the fire. So he asks, what's the ultimate truth? What's the ultimate truth? And the old man takes the sticks and puts them down. And he says, that's it? Now what? And the old man picks the sticks up and puts them on his shoulder again and goes off. So I think now what is the time in this retreat, in this Yom Kippur, it's a question that comes up. And as I say, in the sense, the traditional sense of Rosh Hashanah being the symbol of birth or of rebirth and the cycle of life, which is much bigger than the me, and the whole thing, the whole tradition pointing us to something which is not personal anymore. The birth and the transformation and the passageway, and then what next? Back into life, hopefully renewed, hopefully reset. That's the whole thing about Yom Kippur, reset. Tshuva. So we're in this place, and this is the story, and this is the talk today, the reflection on now what. And here we have a huge dilemma, which is a dilemma which will never ever find a real satisfying answer. And the dilemma of now what, of how do I live, is an existential dilemma. And if we think about questions like that never ever end, like how can I do good in the world without hurting somebody? How can I help myself? Do I hurt myself? What's the best for me, for the world, for others? How do I relate to my life in a way which is right, which works? Many questions came up in the groups and in the one-to-ones that we've been having of this kind. How do I forgive someone that every day presses my button? Do I have to forgive every day and sort of do nothing? And or can I do something? Or can I change something? Or can I stop it in some way? I mean, these questions are with us all our life. And they are, underneath these questions is a deeper question. In fact, these questions have layers, shechvot, and one layer is how much freedom do I really have to act in the world? And that's underneath all these questions. How much can I do it right, this life? How much can I do it right? And am I not always going to fix something and damage something else? And how do I know? And so this the fundamental question, how much can I really know, how much freedom do I really have, is an absolutely big human existential question. It's about fate, goral. It's about karma. It's about control. How much control do I have, and how much am I controlled by life and others? And it goes deeper, because in the Dharma there is a deep understanding that the world isn't a thing out there that we kind of discover as we grow up. But the world is made by us. Paticca Samuppada, dependent arising. The world is created by us. By we learn what is this, that. We learn this thing is a person. We learn this is Stephen. How do I know it's Stephen? Someone told me. That's all. Then does Stephen exist? If no one told me I'm Stephen, then I wouldn't be Stephen. So does Stephen exist? Do we exist as human beings? If the Jungle Book, if we were told by our parents that we are wolves, then we'd be 100% sure the reality is I'm a wolf. That's it. It's very obvious. The world is clear. The world is clear to my dog that that's the world. Not my world. Her world. We make the world according to what we learn and what we say is the world. And the agreement between human beings says this is a plant and this is a hand and this is a color and this is a this is what we eat and this is who we are and this is objects and this exists. And yet we're made of the world. So that we're made of carbon and nitrogen and oxygen, like, you know, that's all we are. And water. So we are not different from the world. But we are standing out and saying, this is the world and this is me. But so it's the world saying that to itself. The world is looking after, out of your eyes. You think it's me looking, it's not. The world is looking at itself out of your eyes. So if I'm making the world, why can't I make it the way I want? It's a fundamental question. If I'm making the world, if I decide that's green, that's red, then I know that's green, that's a plant, that's a body. Why can't I control it? Why do I die? I want to stop it. So on the other hand, we make nothing. We are controlled by everything. Even this mind that is trying to understand what to do is made by carbon, hydrogen and the world and water. It's just a brain made of water. And it's trying to work out reality. It's a crazy situation. We are controlled. I know I'm Stephen only because my parents told me. Therefore, control is somewhere else. We are constantly created and influenced by everything happening. there isn't anything that is not influenced. So that opens a huge mystery, because we create the world and are created by it all the time. And there is a constant relationship between us and the world, which is constantly dynamically changing and moving, in which we create each other, the world and us. So when the Buddha was asked about this, he said the main thing is not to get stuck in duality. So it would be wrong to say that there is nothing there, it's all an imagination, the world doesn't really exist. It would be wrong to say the world exists by itself, determinism, and like science says, science is deterministic. The world exists as it is, and we just learn as much as we can about it. And the opposite is, there isn't really a world, it's all chaos, and nothing much exists there, because it's all, we're being created by, it's dynamic, there's nothing there. And the Buddha said, don't go to this and don't go to that. Come out of extremes of any kind, dualistic. The world doesn't exist as a thing, nor is it empty. And he also said other things that said, nor is it in between. But I will not confuse everybody with that. The middle way is the closest language that he got and Nagarjuna got to what is not this and not that. Nagarjuna, neti neti. The world is not this and nor it's not that. Not a fixed thing and not nothing. Neti neti, not not. So in between not not, there's a middle way. It actually doesn't tell us anything to say there's a middle way. It may be helpful in a way, but it doesn't say what this middle way is. Because in the middle way, in the Dharma sense, is the whole Dharma. The whole Dharma is there in the middle way. That's why it's called the middle way. And the whole Dharma is a huge, huge path of wisdom. And the main thing to take home from it is that it's not in the mind to solve this problem. The mind cannot solve. The best the mind can do here, the mind, namely the cells and experience and thinking, the best the thinking can do here is to give it a label called middle way, or mystery. But mystery is the mind saying so we have to find somewhere else to solve this problem. And really, in a way, in the deepest way, we have to find somebody, somewhere else, something else, in order to help us solve the problem of how to get up in the morning, how to get up in the morning, how to act, how do we come out of birth and rebirth and live. The answer isn't going to be in the mind, because the mind is a product, is a result, is another thing. And all it can say is mystery. So what can know it? If it's not the mind, where do we go to find an answer to the mystery? Where do we go to find the middle way? Where do we go which is not this and not that. And here, I think, is the power of the story of Yonah, of Jonah. So I want to go into the story now, and then it will illustrate the question that I'm throwing out. So Jonah, Yonah, was a prophet living at the time of Ashur, the empire of Assyrians, Ashur. It was 8th century BC. He was a prophet in the biblical sense, and prophets in the biblical sense, Nevi'im, are not Buddhas. They are inspired. They are channeling the word of God. They have a channel to wisdom, but they can get really angry. They can get really pissed off. They can get obsessive. They are political. They are fighting the Kohen, the Kohanim, and the human stupidity. They're activists. They're poets. Beautiful language. They're not perfect. And according to Jewish tradition, Moshe is way above them, the prophets. Moshe is up here. And he was also imperfect in the Jewish tradition. He had many struggles and difficulties. So Yonah is also imperfect. And you can sense from the story, although his name is Yonah ben Amittai, meaning son of Emet, son of truth. Ben Amittai means seeking for truth. His father is truth. So his direction is truth. Or he's born from truth and he's looking for truth. But what happened? He got a voice from inside saying, go to Nineveh and tell the whole Nineveh to wake up and repent and do tshuva. Just sort of, and as you know from history, Nineveh is the capital of Ashur, and Ashur is a hugely cruel and terrible empire. Really, really cruel and devastating, and killing all the people around, and invading all the cities and destroying all the people there. So he couldn't face it. This message he got from his deep inside, to say, God, when you can basically put, like in the Kabbalah, in the Zohar, the closer you are to the word God, the closer you are to the world of your deepest inner place. The journey to God in the Zohar, in the Kabbalah, in Jewish mysticism, is always the journey inside. And the ten Sfirot are the stepping stones to the inner world. From his inner world, namely the voice of God, he was told to go to Nineveh, and he ran away. He couldn't face it. And as I was joking, I think last year, imagine your inner voice told you to go to New York. Or probably better to go to Las Vegas and clean it up. How would you feel? What sort of mission? But yes, the city of Nineveh was, as the Bible says, as the story says, took 3 days to cross it. Huge city, like New York. So he was told, go there and clean it up. And he ran away. And it really is us, because we run away from our highest motivation. We are used to running away. And we think, what's the highest motivation we have, the intention we have, our deepest spiritual journey that we want to make? And actually, what we tend to do is open the iPhone instead, open screens, go to what's comfortable. And as human beings. And so he did. And it says in the story, he ran away. He not only ran away, he ran down. He ran downhill. He ran down to Yafo. He ran down into the bottom of the ship. He ran down. And a storm arrives. So we all know this. When we go downhill, we get it. It gives us bach. You know, we get a tsunami of problems arising when we run away from our real journey or our authentic place. We get makot. We have struggle and this and that, and the telephone has no klita, and I can't get, and this doesn't work, and the fridge is broken, and someone's arguing with me, and the politics, and it all comes on our head. We often feel that, you know, the whole thing is on us. And that's what happened to Yonah and in the ship. A storm, if you like, karma, you can use that word as the unexpected, just brought a storm on his head and on the head of the sailors. And Yonah went down more. And it's a really excellent description of depression. Dikaon. He went into his room in the ship, he shut the door, he went to kind of sleep, he went into down there, and the sailors were struggling, he couldn't help them. The storm was going to break the ship, he just didn't care. He was finished in Dikaon, in deep depression there. And the sailors came to him, and they were basically good people, and they said, you know, what's this? What's happening? He said, it's me. Throw me overboard, because it's because of me. All this is happening. All this bad thing is happening to the ship. It's my fault. Throw me. And they didn't want to. They threw everything else out. They tried to say they didn't want to do that. And in the end he said, you have no choice. You have to throw me over, otherwise you'll all die. And they did. And then he got swallowed by a fish. Big fish. And here is an interesting place, because fish, in all the kind of mystical symbol, is the unconscious, is the symbol of the deep place in us. It's the spirit of the sea, of the water. It's Naga in the Indian mythology, the serpent that lives in the lake or in the sea, that is challenging us and yet giving us power. The Naga is always the place where, in the mythology, like in the Mahabharata, the challenge that the Naga is stopping you passing through the unconscious into liberation, there'll be a Naga there. The dragon in the Christian mythology, you have to kill the dragon in order to be liberated. You have to at least challenge the dragon. The dragon will stop you. The snake in the Jewish mythology or Mesopotamia, Middle Eastern, it's the snake. In Egyptian, there's also, there all the time, there is this reptile or fish representing the unconscious, the power which is stopping you, and also power that you have to deal with to liberation. You cannot cross there with the ordinary mind. You have to go to this place of the fish. And that's a struggle. So he got swallowed by the fish, and there in the belly of the fish, and it's exactly that place of going down into emptiness, going down into darkness, going down into nothingness, swallowed by the whale. And he said it, There is nowhere lower I can go. This is the bottom. And in the text, it's very beautifully expressed. The bottom of the sea, the bottom of the earth, the bottom of... the image I have from 9/11 is ground zero. There's the image of the bottom. Ground zero, zel, zero. Efes. La apes et atzmenu. Et yonah. La apes. He went to zero. And it's really the place of emptiness, which you all know from the Buddhist tradition, Buddhist practice, the place of emptiness is the place of knowing emptiness. It's being in the empty. It's knowing the nature of things as empty. It's really meeting emptiness. That anythingness is illusion. That the emptiness is the closest we can get to the ultimate place. And we know how it helps us. We know how important it is. We have a thought that's going round and round in our mind. The minute we can sense this thought is made of nothing, it's coming from nowhere, it's going to nowhere, and it's made of nothing, that's it. We dealt with it. So it always, for us, is a place closer to the truth of things. And Yonah went down into this place, and he cries and he prays and he surrenders. And there's something very powerful about it. And in this day of Yom Kippur is symbol of it, because really, lots of things are coming up for you in the day. Sograim, I don't know whether Iran and myself are teaching our role as, in a way, teachers or guides in this day. I have no idea if we're doing it right, if it's helpful or not helpful. I think neither of us really know. But I do know that we didn't offer a structured retreat, like a usual Vipassana retreat that feels very structured. Now you've, and we're talking about this today, now you're with the breath, then you do this, then you do that, then next day this, next day that, and the usual track of a normal retreat. There's a lot here which is is unstructured, and touching important things like forgiveness and existential moments, but not really offering a kind of a ground of systematic method, and which could have maybe be easier for people. So, but inviting surrender, and here is an important place which we didn't actually talk about too much in this retreat, but inviting surrender. We give up. Business as usual doesn't exist anymore. Surrender to what is the deepest place. Surrender to emptiness. Surrender to nothing. Surrender to fasting. To give up. Give up the game. Get out of the game. Give up the game. It doesn't work anymore. Get off the wheel, to use the Buddhist language. You get off the wheel and surrender. And when we surrender to this place of nothing, this empty, this unconscious, the difficulties we face, the confusion we face, the dark places in us, the things that we can't solve, the questions that don't leave us, when we surrender, something radical happens. It's at that place that a real rebirth happens. And it's not, we can't kind of pretend it, which we could. be a lot easier if we can sort of pretend ke'ilu, go through death, ke'ilu, and rebirth. But we really do need to surrender to those places which are empty, which are not us, which are not the usual mind, which are not the usual security, the usual world which we think we know, the usual certainties, the usual dependence. The things, as long as I have my food in the fridge and a good job and a good family and a good house and a good this and a okay and a this right and this right, and then everything is okay. But it's not okay. So from that place of surrender, of total surrender, you could say death and rebirth of Yona, of going into the bottom, the emptiness, the nothingness place, surrender also to there, and Yona did it. And from there he was reborn or resurrected or got new life. And sure, yalla, I'm okay. I can go to Nineveh and I can tell them, those guys, they have to shape up and stop being cruel killers. And they listened. They fasted 3 days. We're only doing 1 day. They did 3 days. And the whole city, from the king down to everybody, they got the message, which I think is like total miracle to do such a thing. I mean, think about it. Whoa. Imagine the power that Yona had to do such a thing. But I think that we can, if we look at the people that made real, real change in the world, they've gone through, they have done that. Nelson Mandela, 20 plus years in prison, that was his belly of the whale, and he came out of it and changed a whole nation. Dalai Lama's big inspiration to the whole planet, coming from his deep authentic practice and realization, and Dzogchen, practice of emptiness. So Yona, he goes up the hill, makes himself a hut, sits inside it, watches what happens, and the city survives. They repented. And he's pissed off. He says, I don't like this. There's something wrong here. They're not going to be punished. This empire, Ashur, that's killing millions, destroying the Jewish people, destroying every other people around, totally making people slaves, building a huge city with beautiful buildings based on slavery and cruelty, and no one's going to punish them. They're just going to say, yeah, okay, we fasted, now we're okay. So he was pissed off, and he went up, sat on the hill, and God, the inner voice, gave him a kikayon. A kikayon grew where he was sitting and gave him shade. It was a hot sun and he was struggling. And a kikayon grew and gave him shade. And then after a little bit, the kikayon died from a disease and he had no shade. And he was there under the sun, and he said, he cried, and he said, I want to die. He kept saying, it's two or three times in the story, he kept saying, I want to die. Like, okay, we heard it before. We know that. You keep saying it. Shut up already. The inner voice, the God, said to him, look, you feel you are depressed and upset about a plant that you didn't have anything to do with. You didn't make this plant, and you didn't stop it growing, you didn't kill it, and yet you want to die. And this plant came and gave you something and then went again and you're crying. Do you mean to say that you want a city of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people to die? You want it, you know, you, Yona, that is dependent on a plant, like a little kikayon. You're dependent, you're suffering, you're vulnerable. You want 100,000 people to die, and animals, and children, because of you, your ideas of sachar va'onish, reward and punishment, your human ideas. So that was a voice also saying, go out of the usual mind that is trying to say there should be rules. I should know that the rules should work, the world should work according to rules, sachar va'onish. But whose rules are they? Sachar va'onish, reward and punishment, is not God's rules, it's human beings that want life to be a bit more comfortable and know the story. So reward and punishment, sachar va'onish, is just for humans in the mind, in our usual mind, to make us feel better about life, that there is existing reward and punishment. We don't like life to be karma, uncontrolled. We want to control. So reward and punishment is the hunger of the mind for control, and for things to make sense according to the mind. So, all of this story is telling us that the understanding of how to act in the world is coming from a place that is not the mind, that is not the usual mind, such as reward and punishment, such as I should know how to do things, I should be able to think what to do, think it out, I should be able to change things by thinking, I should control, have more control, I have control over things, if I think things out, I can work it out, and then have more control. And the story of Yonah is telling us the real place to understand all of this is coming from another place altogether, not the mind. It's coming from the belly of the whale. It's coming from the place of beyond the mind, of emptiness, of surrender, of unconscious, deep unconscious wisdom, where we let go of everything human and we are drawing our wisdom from another place, not from the usual mind thinking. When the Buddha talked about the kind of mind needed for this, he used the word seeing and knowing. The word seeing and knowing, well, that's the translation, I can't remember the Pali. But it's not, seeing and knowing is a slogan for quite a deep wisdom, which is a kind of deep knowing. Sometimes we can say intuition is there, but intuition is a small part of a deep knowing, of a wisdom of knowing, knowingness, of deep awareness, which is not in forms or in constructions or in thought or in words or in language or in conditioning. And that's the seeing and knowing, and it's the liberated place. It's not something we don't know, we don't touch. We're actually touching it. In meditation, we actually touch these places. When we go to places which are subtle, which are just there, which are just our being, there is a knowing there. And we say, oh, it's nothing. I know the breath. But it's not thinking about the breath. It's not expecting the breath to do something. It's not wanting the breath to be kind of like this or like that. It's not about, it doesn't have any agencies. It might be a sense of just being, letting go, a moment of an existential moment that has no beginning, no end, and no logic, and no description, and no language. There are places that we touch. We're not talking about, you know, only Yona and the Buddha. We do touch places like that, but we don't give them much importance. The liberated place is like in the room here, there is light. We don't see the light. We see what the light does. So the light allows us to see the wall here, which is lit up. But we don't see the light that lights the wall. We just see the wall. So the light in the room exists, and we all know it, and we all have a sense there is light in this room, but we don't see it with the usual eyes. Okay, but there's something there that does know on a deeper level that the objects are not the whole story, that there's things happening which are not just the objects. There's something in us that does know that. So a really good message from, in relation to karma and fate, in the story of Yona is very similar to the story of Angulimala that I told a day before yesterday, that fate is changeable. Karma is not a kind of a steamroller that just rolling along, kind of controlling everything. We can change things. We can change ourselves. We can change our life. We have much more freedom than we realize. And it needs us to go to the belly of the whale, like Yona, and realize, or like Angulimala, that never mind, he killed 999 people. He could still be a monk and then go out and heal everybody. We can, because in a way we're making the world as we go along, we are in a dynamic relationship with the world. The world and us are making each other. It's not a fixed world which is done and finished and we have to somehow manage in a fixed world and find our way in a fixed world. No, the world and us are making each other all the time. So that is the real understanding which allows us to do radical different things and to be different and to make change, because the world isn't a fixed, ready-made, all done, zero there, it's fixed, I've grown up, I'm an adult, the world exists, I now just have to kind of manage, the hitmo dead. I just don't like that word. Hitmoded, to cope. That's all life is. Hitmodedut. No, it's not. No, it's not. Everything is changeable. We have far more power than we realized. And any time we can be reborn and go out and change Nineveh or Tel Aviv. Or maybe start with our house and our neighbors. Okay, start there. Never mind. And part of that also relates to the practice that we've been doing over these last 2 or 3 days in relation to forgiveness. Forgiveness isn't a thought. In the story of Yonah, forgiveness happens through the word of God, actually. In Yonah paying attention to the highest place, but forgiveness happened to the whole city of Nineveh. Forgiveness happened to Yonah himself. So it's not, forgiveness is not a small thing. We need to go to this deeper place of the belly of the whale. Forgiveness comes from above. One of the most beautiful expressions of this in the Jewish world is the Kabbalistic or the Zohar, the Zohar expression for primal consciousness or primal awareness or deep awareness, which is not the usual mind, is Atika Kadisha, meaning the Atika is primal. And the Tibetans call it the same thing. They call it primal. Primal Atik or Rishoni. So it's fundamental. It's base awareness, if you like. And it's called Atika Kadisha. It's holy and ancient or primal or Rishoni. And there's a very beautiful... someone threw it out from Avraham Lido, who's the teacher of my wife on Zohar and Kabbalah. And he threw out this comment that Atika Kadisha, that's the primal consciousness, has no language except one word it says, which is forgiveness. I think that's knockout. That the primal consciousness has one word in it, and that's forgiveness. Amazing. So one more message from I want to just raise now from Yonah, and that is the message of compassion, because it's something he missed, and the invitation is to him to be compassionate to the people of Nineveh. The invitation is to be compassionate. When faced with the bigness of things, when faced with the vulnerability, when the Kikayon died and he was faced with the Pigiyut, Shavririyut, vulnerability, fragility of life, our response to the fragility of life is to know that we are not different from every other living being. Also the people of Nineveh, never mind what they did, they are also fragile, each one, and each animal, and each child, and each human being, and so are we. And this fragility, the Shavrirut, is the source of compassion, understanding that us and all beings are hanging on a thread. The same image in the Kabbalah, the same image in Tibetan teaching, that the whole of life is hanging on a very thin thread. And it's the emptiness there. So we are hanging on a thin thread, and that creates compassion. that creates a sense of affinity. We are together with all beings in this place of vulnerability, of fragility. And it's a beautiful message. When we suffer and struggle, and we don't have so much mindfulness, and we're feeling bad, and the mindfulness isn't working, and we went on a retreat only 6 months ago, and I don't know what to do with this, with all this struggle. But compassion kicks in. Compassion is the place that we go to in those moments when we feel our vulnerability, our fragility, our struggle, and we know that it's in the life is hanging on one thread, and all life is hanging on one thread, and we are one with all of life. And that touches the heart, and compassion. And compassion is a relief and a release. So there is the Yona journey. That's why Ben Amitai is called Yona Ben Amitai. He searched for truth and he found it. He's found his rebirth and he found his teaching. And the final word or the final sentence of the story is enigmatic. In other words, it doesn't tell you if he understood compassion or not. It doesn't have an ending, this story. If you look at the last sentence of the story, it's kind of left a question and silence. It doesn't have a nice ending, like Hollywood. It just, in a way, ends in silence, which is like saying all the rest is silence. And I really picked this up, by the way, in my book. And I wrote a poem at the end of the book, which is inspired by this, the ending of Yona. There is a poem in the book. And that, what does it mean? All the rest is silence. Everything else, that's it. No more words. So I think that's the ending of the story of Yona, is silence, and the ending of this talk. So let's go to silence.